Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandergrift.
It's Tuesday, July 30th. From HBR2, it's The Conversation. Here's some of the talk coming up this hour. When the bank says no, two women on a mission could say yes.
Poetry without rhyme. We've got more reasons.
Celebrating four decades of homegrown attorneys.
And a guy who can justifiably say, I'm at the top of the world, Mom.
Plus Deutsche Welle, the cool cones in the backyard, putting the chill on your AC bill, and today's reality check.
Support for NPR comes from America's Natural Gas. Learn how Los Angeles reduced emissions for its entire bus fleet by switching to natural gas. Thinkaboutit.org.
This is The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. We've recovered from Flossie reasonably well, I'd say.
Are recovering, especially hopefully those 900 people in Hana who lost their power.
Well, it should be back online pretty soon. The weather is pretty much okay at this point.
Yeah, a little gray, a little rainy for today, but we'll keep an eye out and we'll let you know. But much better that all the hype that we thought we were going to have to deal with turned out to be a little less so, but that's okay. Better to be overprepared. And while we're talking about preparation, if you've got a business, well, what do you do when the bank says no and you know your idea is a real comer? If your business concerns Hawaii food sustainability, there are two people possibly ready to buy into your dream, literally, with over $1 million in microloans. It's not free money, but it could free you for greater success. Denise Albano is half of the duo who created Food for Thought, and she has a little for us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth. Good morning, Chris.
Looking at how you decided to do this, do you kind of look in the rearview mirror and think, wow, why?
Every day. You know, both Patty and I started our careers in the nonprofit world, really doing grant making. And we realized at some point that that was just not a sustainable model. And the second thing that drew us to microfinance was that we realized people don't always need grants. What they need is an opportunity, resource, capital, to really start and live their dreams. And we thought, there's got to be a better way for this. And we did some research and saw the amazing impact that microfinance was having internationally, which is where we started our work. But being both of us being back from Hawaii, really wanted to bring the program home to where our hearts were.
Is there a different psychology in giving a grant as opposed to giving a microloan?
You know, there really is a huge difference in that when we do the loan making, people who know us from previous careers said, why are you doing loans and not grants? And we go back to some of the stories and some of the people who have actually taken loans from us, and the amount of pride and satisfaction and the fact that they are living their passion and being successful cannot be described in words. They were able to take a dream, make it happen, have some capital, pay it back because they knew that in paying back this loan, someone else would then get money also for their turn.
It's that payback factor.
Absolutely. For us, it means that people who are able to, who don't have, are able to have and become successful, pass that on to others who may not have and then be successful in return.
When you look at a business that you might finance, what do you look specifically at, besides the fact that you're asking for it to be, at least in Hawaii, in the area of food sustainability, but what means something to you that makes somebody a candidate better or not so good?
We looked at this for a while before we actually laid out the loan program. And for us, we didn't want to go with the traditional criteria that banks use because we learned internationally, and we're seeing it now in Hawaii, that there are people who would never meet that criteria who are tremendously successful anyway. And for us, that meant looking at someone's passion about what they were doing. Did they truly believe? Did they love what they were doing? Was it going to be something that was good not only for themselves, but for their family and for the community that they lived in? And then we built around that the support, because we know that a loan is just a loan. You need technical support. You need to be hooked into distribution. You need to be hooked into a network. And we built that into our loans. So we offer that in addition to the capital.
So it's not just the social consciousness part of it, which is different from the way a bank would look at this, but also how you can mentor them or lead them into a network where they have the greater chance of success.
Absolutely. And therefore, we make loans to not just individuals, but to organizations or small businesses, because we have farmers who have taken loans. We have people who are involved in distribution who have taken loans, and we can connect the two and say, you know, we all need each other in this, and we can ensure that we'll all be successful.
In a way, this is a model of interdependence, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's what people used to call the co-op model, in a way, where, and we learned this from doing international work, where people who live in the villages are so small that I need you to be successful because I'm going to sell to you. So you need to be successful also to help me distribute. And we learned that we can do this in Hawaii, which is a very small state when it's all is said and done.
That business model, though, is very different, as you mentioned, from the traditional one that most of us learn in business
sure.
schools or growing up in business families.
Sure.
But is this model now changing the way the world of finance, at least at this level, is looking at being able to perpetuate greater success for businesses who are worthy?
I believe so, because we're talking about small business again, which is really the backbone of economies. We need big businesses to support that, but in the small business world, we're all in this together, and no one can survive if you aren't also looking at the next level down the stream. And it's in that distribution chain. Again, when we make our loans, it's so wonderful that the local food system is such a big movement now. So we joined a movement rather than creating one, and we've been embraced. And one of the nice things is now we have this $1 million in capital to really loan out to people who will not or may not qualify at the bank.
You sort of have a sustainability within a sustainability model that you're using, but yet it seemed as if, Denise, that people were not very quick on the uptake to, A, believe this is happening and they could possibly be involved with it, and not really talking to you until very, very recently.
Yes, part of that was getting the word out that it was available. And I find that one of the stumbling blocks that we step into is that people have wonderful dreams and they have wonderful plans about a successful business. But you still need a business plan and some idea of how you're going to show that you're going to make money for yourselves and also to pay back the loan. But because we've run into this and seen this, we've partnered with organizations that can provide that technical support about your business plan, about your financial planning, and we'll also do it ourselves. Again, we recognize that when that's there, when all the tools are there, in addition to the loan, that's what makes someone very successful.
So who's gotten a loan lately? And you don't have to give us names,
sure.
but have you been able to grant some of those loans?
We have. We have some big projects. We have some individual farmers who've come to us and said, I need a loan. I want to expand. We've had big projects. I'll name one, which is Kakao Ivi on the North Shore. In Kaneohe, which is a big project where they're not only doing food production, they're also doing taro production and educational programs for the community.
And what's the average loan amount?
The average loan amount right now is about $20,000. But because of this grant, we are now looking at loans from as small as $5,000 to as large as $100,000. And that's the average range. We can go lower, we can go higher, depending on what the business is.
Well, you'll have to keep us informed about who's taking you up on the offer, because it's not very often that you get to hear that there's actually this kind of a loan offer out there. And we wish you all the success.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Denise Albano is half of Food for Thought. She and her business partner, Patty Chang, offer microloans to deserving individuals and programs who can't qualify for a bank loan. There is a catch, though. Remember, the loans have to be for food sustainability, and details are on hbr2.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Central Pacific Bank, offering the exceptional checking account, which includes an identity theft protection package that alerts users if personal information is compromised. Learn more at centralpacificbank.com.
43 million people without a home, they all have voices.
When I was 6 years old, I was in the camp. I lost my family, like my mom and my 7 siblings. I don't know where they are right now.
Refugee stories in their own words, the human consequences of headlines from Syria to Nairobi. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
Soon there might be more Hawaii-made products in the grocery store thanks to a microloan. But right now, here's a little cool food from Maui.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukahoolabe.
Today, Flossie may still be making some of us glossy, but on most summer days, the Hawaiian sun gets unbearable. The lure of a frozen treat to cool off often sends many folks out for Hawaiian-style fix, an ice-cold sweet cone of shave ice. Now, Valley Isle locals have another option, Guri Guri Sherbet. They say it's better than shave ice or anything. Its unique texture is both creamy and crystalline, as if a shave ice cart and ice cream truck had a simultaneous head-on collision into your tongue. Well, that's according to one reviewer, at least. Guri Guri Sherbet has proved so popular that other places have tried to imitate it, offering a Maui-style sherbet, but the family store that invented it has people lining up out the door. The Tasaka family's Guri Guri shop in the old Kahului Mall scoops sherbet for many customers each day. And so for today's backyard quiz, we'd like to know, what's the daily scoop tally? We'll take the answer out of the deep freeze in the next half hour.
Good morning. I'm Jerry Silva from AARP Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hpr2.org.
Okay, so it may still be a little rainy and gray today as Flossie is dissipating, but you know, while we're still considering the cool attraction of that Guri Guri Sherbet in the backyard quiz, let's also put the chill on the cost for your air conditioning, too. Kana Hawaii's Olagan is here to do that with more summer solutions for freezing out high utility bills. It's good to see you again.
Same here.
Now, the AC, I got to admit, is probably not my favorite appliance. I don't use it a whole lot, but a lot of people do. And at a very high cost.
At extremely high cost. And there are three things that we found that can drastically reduce that cost. And the first is to take another pass and reduce incoming heat into the room. So use outdoor plants or blinds, or if you have to get light in, use some tint. So window tints now can block 70% of the incoming heat.
What about if you can't necessarily move your AC?
If you can't move it, then you want to look at other things that you can do. So one big area there is to use a thermostat. So if your unit doesn't have a thermostat or a timer, you can buy one to plug and play. It's about $100. And what these units do is that you can control it from your phone or from your computer. So if you use it at night and say you're asleep by 11, then you can program it to increase the heat at 11 o'clock.
$100 to do that, though. What kind of money are you talking about in offsetting some savings here?
That would take about a year to get your money back if you use it lightly. If you use the timer function a lot, you can actually get your money back in about 3 to 4 months.
Now, what about the unit itself? As we were talking about a few weeks ago with refrigerators and other appliances, there are some that are certainly more energy aware than others, and
right.
You also have to do the maintenance, right?
Absolutely. So, for example, when you use your dryer, you have to clean that lint after every time you dry. But people don't do that with their air conditioner. So one tip there is to get an electrostatic air filter. And so these are reusable. You can wash them, and it encourages you to change it frequently, like maybe at least once a month.
Isn't there also a filter that lets you know when it's time to change the filter?
There's a filter whistle that you can put on, and it'll start singing when it gets too clogged. And so that's about $1. You can pick one up at a local market.
Okay, so let's forget about the AC for a second, but look at the idea of keeping cool. Mm-hmm. For a lot of us, that means ceiling fans or other fans. Good idea?
Great idea. Ceiling fans use about 10% of the energy of an air conditioning unit, and you can actually get a great rebate from Hawaii Energy. So go to hawaiienergy.com. You can print a rebate form and save about $35 off a ceiling fan.
Sometimes, though, you have the ability to change which direction that ceiling fan goes. Does that make a difference?
It makes a huge difference. If it's incorrectly set, then you're actually drawing the heat the other way. And so, and if you have a ceiling fan, you want to make sure that it's designed and set to push the air down.
So does that mean it's moving clockwise or counterclockwise?
It depends on the blades that you have.
And so and how they're actually set.
Right. So you can just go underneath and wet your hand and feel it. So if you feel the wind coming down, then it's set properly. If you don't, then flip the switch and then it'll work properly.
These are not really, you know, high-tech things that you're talking about. Wet your hand, put it underneath, see which way it's going. But a lot of people don't do that. Why is it that we tend to complain a lot, but we don't want to do some of the simple stuff?
You know, we're not sure. It's been surprising to us that people can do very simple things, but they don't go and do it. And so I think the issue is literacy. They just don't know how to do it. If you spend 20 minutes on YouTube, you'll find a host of videos on how to properly maintain your system, how to set it up for efficiency, how to block incoming heat, and so forth.
You have talked to a lot of people over the last year or two as Kona Hawaii has been looking at energy efficiency. Is there one thing that surprised you the most about how people use either their AC or their fans?
The one thing that surprised us was there are a lot of folks that want the room cooled when they come home from work. And so the only way they'd accomplish that is to leave it on 24/7. And so that shocked me. I didn't know that people did that, knowing the cost of that. And so for those families, we just set up a simple timer so that it would kick on when it should kick on versus being on the whole day.
And this is one of those $10 timers you plug in the wall?
Oh, absolutely. They're on sale for $5, actually. So it's a great deal. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks very much for the tips. We'll put more of them on the Facebook page, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Olin. Olin Logan is Kona Hawaii's executive director, and each Tuesday this summer, he's been bringing us more energy-saving solutions that can work for you right now. The link to today's tips, again, is on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Poetry is about layers of meaning, and your first reading of any poem is unlikely to yield all its secrets. The late Hawaii poet Steve Schrader was fond of wordplay, and sometimes in his work, language that seems at first to be merely playful reveals a darker purpose on second and third reading. To quote a line from one of his poems, obscurity is both its best and worst feature. Susan Schultz, editor of Tin Fish Press, is about to release a new volume of Schrader's work, and she's here with a preview. Good morning.
Thanks, Chris. Good morning.
You had to really believe in this poet to put in the work you've done to put out this edition.
Oh, I do. He's someone who sent me work in probably 2005, early 2006, and I opened the envelope and was kind of blown back by it. It was absolutely wonderful material. So I accepted one of the poems, which came out in Tin Fish 17 when we had a journal. Mm-hmm. And invited him to come to a reading, which he did, so I met him just once. And then couldn't find him when it came time to do the proofing of the journal issue, and it turned out that he had died. Mm-hmm. I found out through his friend Warren Iwasa that he had left two full manuscripts of poems. And ever since then, I've been trying to get the rights to publish them, and I finally did a year or two ago. And have been working on it ever since.
There's an enormous amount of stuff in here, subject matter. It's very dense mm-hmm. material, yeah?
It's two full manuscripts of poems, which we're publishing as one book called The Arc of the Day and The Imperfectionist. The books are similar, but they're not exactly the same. As Victoria Nelson points out in one of the blurbs, the first book tends to be a little bit more ironic and oblique. Mm-hmm. One of his lines is oblique oblige. and the second book, The Imperfectionist, tends to have more sestinas, pontums, haiku, a lot of playfulness in which he's playing around a lot with language.
But he's got a very detailed knowledge of form as well.
He had a very detailed knowledge of a lot of things, yeah. And form is one of them.
And language as well. I mean, just use of words, the sound of words.
He had an MFA in poetry from Iowa, which he got in the late 60s, mm-hmm. So he'd cut his teeth on that. My sense is that after he moved to Hawaii, he had stopped writing for many, many years. Hmm. He earned his keep as an instructor of English, a graphic designer, a journalist. Mm-hmm. And my suspicion is that these are the poems of his last few years.
Because of the mood of the poems, the feelings that come out in them?
That and things like references to software, references. Oh, there's yeah. one poem that references Donald Rumsfeld. So they're certainly the poems of the 2000s anyway.
He's among other things, a punster
mm-hmm.
who clearly, you know, sort of knows that a word can be given, you know, half a dozen shades of meaning. And he,
right.
and he plays with that. Sometimes he's almost laughing at you.
Or laughing at himself, with himself.
Yeah.
I don't know. His relationship to his audience, I think, is difficult to suss out.
Yeah.
But he definitely good with language, and also very learned in the sense that you can get to know a poem over time by looking up quite a few references.
Mm-hmm.
So you can read it on many different levels.
And that's what I mean by dense, that it's not, you know, I wouldn't suggest that you read these at a couple of sittings.
I had a professor in college who, when we were reading a Robert Frost poem, said, "This poem is dense and so are we." And I think that occasionally with these poems, I've had the same sense.
Right, right, yeah. The reader's density matches the what's on the page.
But another thing that's very interesting to me is that particular kind of density seems fairly modernist or postmodernist in many ways, but the poems take place often on Waimanalo Beach, which is
yeah.
where he lived. So there's very much an attachment to Hawaii in these poems, which you wouldn't find in other poems that you might associate with this way of writing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very interesting kind of mix of traditions and ways of thinking about the world.
The references to Hawaii seem to introduce a warmth into the work.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think?
Yeah, well, he lived on Waimanalo Beach in this old kind of decaying building, which is called the Castle among his friends. Mm-hmm. It actually does have a tower or a turret or whatever you call it.
Perfect place for a poet.
Yeah, and he sort of like Yeats's tower in a way,
yeah.
but he lived there, and it has these big windows that look out on Waimanalo Beach and the ironwood trees. It's a gorgeous location. I met the man who takes care of the place, who probably owns the place, and it seemed like his full-time job was keeping it standing. But Schrader lived there for over 35 years, and he had this amazing view of the world from there.
Susan, let's read a quick poem, because there's a line in it that sounds like his personality to me.
Okay. The poem you requested is called Drowning with Fish. I don't recall us all having this much fun back from the far voyage with the family's face. I do remember the type on the page, the light on the lake, my dad's undercurrents, the vacuum of the spoken word, full of peculiar whims or stubborn notions, cantankerous and eccentric. I ply my trade by another stretch of dappled water.
You see the line that I thought referred to him, cantankerous and eccentric, I ply my trade.
Yes, also, from what I know of him, he had a large family.
Mm-hmm.
Lives in still some of them live in the Midwest, and they vacation in the summer next to a big lake.
That's his stretch of dappled water is Waimanalo Beach.
Exactly. Then. So he'd spent his yeah. childhoods by this lake with his father's undercurrents. His father was a nuclear physicist who was involved in the Manhattan Project.
Yikes!
And many of these poems have to do with trying to think through that, also being the father of a son whose mother's family came from Hiroshima. So there's a lot of...
there's a lot to be found in these poems.
Working through that in these poems.
Well, great to have you on the show, Susan. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Susan Schultz is the editor of Tin Fish Press, which is releasing a new volume of Schrader's work. And she is the author of She's Welcome to Her Disease, Dementia Blog, Volume 2. You can learn more about her and Tin Fish Press at hpr2.org.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week, it's homemade Nutella, Stump the Cook with Ted Allen, host of Chopped, and Remembering Julia Child. Join us. That's this week on The Splendid Table from 8 p.m.
Saturday morning at 9, following Weekend Edition.
HPR listeners who are also station members share in the station's vision to build this network into a truly statewide service. Mahalo to Jana Otto of Honolulu, Janet Karger of Milton, Massachusetts, and Regina Pfeiffer of Honolulu for their membership gifts. A growing number of members are choosing lifetime membership as their preferred way to support HPR now and into the future. Lifetime members pledge a monthly gift of $5 or more. That continues until you tell us otherwise. To become a lifetime member today, call 955-8821 during business hours or follow the support link at hpr2.org. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. It's 8:30. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Montessori Community School in Makiki. Enrollment information for the preschool program is available at montessorihawaii.org or 522-0244.
The rain may have you wishing for the comfort of a good cup of coffee, preferably from Hawaii. But that may be getting tougher to find. The coffee berry borer is to blame. So how bad is Hawaii's infestation? Bad. Very bad. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has more of that story in today's Reality Check. Well, are you telling me I should be a teetotaler then?
You know, I'm a huge coffee fan, and I love Kona coffee, but this is really a serious matter. And by the way, I trip up with the pronunciation as well. It's coffee berry borer. And yeah, and what these are little beetles, not from Liverpool, but they live in the coffee cherries. That's the fruit around the bead. The bean, and they're very hard to study and control. And we don't even know how it got here, but we know it started showing up around 2010, about 3 years ago. And is really, they multiplied rapidly, and they are having some devastating consequences on the Kona coffee crop, as you know, on the Big Island, something that we all cherish here.
When we talked to some of the experts that have been brought in over the last couple of years, some from South America, where they too have had a great deal of infestations.
Colombia, right.
Right, but yet look at Brazil this year having a pretty good year when it comes to coffee. The point that we've always gotten from the experts is that this is something we can deal with. It's not going to be pretty. It's not going to be instant, but it's something that we have to work toward, which kind of goes back to why the USDA was you know, providing this $1 million to be able to cope a little bit.
That's right. That's something that Senator Mazie Hirono and Representative Tulsi Gabbard strongly pushed for that $1 million to go to research. You know, part of the problem for us here is that this beetle, this coffee berry borer beetle, is not common in the U.S. We're the only state that grows coffee, so that's something that we're just now having to grapple with. By the way, on top of that money from the feds, the state legislature is going to give has already allocated $500,000 for research, and I think another $300,000 for mitigation for control. So we are starting to deal with this, as you indicated, South America finding ways to deal with it. Hopefully, we can have some success, and that this research money will go a long way to helping us understand the problem.
And you can sit down to your cup of Kona coffee and enjoy yourself. All right, Jay.
Yes, that's the goal. Thanks, Beth, and I'll talk to you tomorrow, okay?
You bet. We'll do. Thanks, Chad. Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Travasa Hana, an experiential resort on Maui. Our partnership with Mokulele Airlines and Enterprise makes getting to Hana convenient with daily flights to Hana and one-way rental cars. Travasa.com/Hana.
Good morning, I'm Chris Vandercook. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2, and coming up, a big UH birthday, the answer to the backyard quiz, and a guy who takes sports to the extreme and to the top of the world.
In local news, one item from the headlines 4 decades ago was the establishment of the UH Law School. It was the vision of then-Chief Justice William S. Richardson. And over all its years, the UH Law School has shaped Hawaii politics and public policy with interdisciplinary studies, a focus on Asia and the Pacific, and indigenous rights. And as the school celebrates its 40th anniversary, some of the alumni are reviewing its history and accomplishments. Alan Ho was in the first class to graduate, and this morning we look back and into the future through his eyes. Thanks so much for coming in.
Aloha, Beth Ann. It's an honor. It's a privilege. And when you use that term 40 years, it is sort of
tough to hear sometimes, huh?
Yes.
Well, you know, on one way you can see that it's been 40 years because you can clearly see the progress of the school. On the other hand, it must feel like it's a blink of the eye. But it was no slam dunk that this was going to happen and that the law school was going to be funded and to be established. There was a great deal of struggle 40 years ago.
There was. But I think the overriding principle was a commitment that our father's generation, if you will, made to themselves and made to their families, that they would advance the cause, I think, of education and educational opportunity for Hawaii's kids. And I look back, and I'm forever grateful for those young men who fought so courageously in World War II and decided we are going to go home and we're going to help to shape Hawaii's future.
When you look at the picture of your class and just, you know, marvel at where everyone has gone in those 40 years, you included, the faces seem so different, though, from the faces that we see in many graduating classes in other law schools today. Is that one of the real benefits of having this develop in and of and about Hawaii, is that diversity?
Absolutely. And I think if you look at that first class, you will see something very unique besides the fact of our ethnic diversity in Hawaii. We, I think, are very proud of the fact that that first class probably was the only class that had a diverse enrollment based on the gender, male-female. In those days, females still had a very difficult time getting into law school, and I think the University of Hawaii Law School began its mission with 30% women, and that was pretty awesome.
Particularly for 1976.
Absolutely. Actually, 1973.
Well, that's true. Time when you started, right. not when you graduated.
Right.
But looking at those facts now and putting them into a modern context, what is it that you see that the law school particularly does so well here that other states are looking to us to, in a way, help them develop?
I think what it does, it offers an example of what it means to work in unison, work together, work as a community. One of the things that we're very proud of, and being a Native Hawaiian, one of the things that we always talked about is that, you know, we're all in the same canoe, and if we don't kind of paddle together, we're going to go absolutely nowhere. And that's part of who we are in Hawaii. People recognize the fact that, yeah, we may have wildly divergent views and opinions, but at the end of the day, we need to come to a consensus to move forward.
And as that relates to creating law for indigenous peoples, and particularly Pacific Islanders and Hawaiians, you know, what a shame it would be to have to go to a school someplace east and say, oh, let's go look this up, where if, you know, we hadn't done a lot of that work here in Hawaii.
Absolutely. And I'm very proud of the fact that one of my classmates is law professor Melody McKenzie, and the program that she helped to kind of create, I think it must be like 10 or 12 years ago, is now nationally and even internationally renowned as a repository, not only for Native Hawaiian principles of law and practices, but indigenous rights.
You talk about all of this stemming from the community. Dean Avi Soifer said that he believes that there's no other law school in the United States that is as important to its community as the Richardson Law School is to Hawaii. Is that Avi just being kind about it, or do you have so many ways in which you can point to not only just what we just talked to about, but where this is really true, how much Hawaii depends on its law school?
You know, I would agree with Avi's assessment, and I think that's one of the reasons that he was attracted to the University of Hawaii law program, and one of the reasons why he's been so successful over these years. We are not hesitant to delve into a lot of those areas that other people tend to shy away from simply because they are afraid of that topic or subject. We've been very fortunate in attracting highly competent professors who have come here to share kind of their concerns and their interest to help us grow and learn in the most broad areas of those issues that are regulated by, quote, our legal system.
Now, after 40 years and so many who have come through the law school who have wound up in politics, in business, all through our community, do you count certain successes because of the law school that, had the law school not been there, perhaps we might not have?
Absolutely. I think we would not be as rich, if you will, in terms of those issues that our community now willingly addresses on a regular basis had we simply depended upon lawyers entering the profession in Hawaii, basically coming out of law schools who were, one, may know the black letter law extremely well, but unable to relate to the uniqueness of our island state.
So you're talking about cultural literacy and also, you know, real issues like environmental law.
Yeah, absolutely. Across the board, you have every aspect in terms of, you know, the interdisciplinary approach that our law school focuses on in terms of engineering, in terms of environmental, in terms of, and even now in terms of, I guess, those issues that relate to our agricultural production.
And medical ethics.
And
I mean, once upon
ethics.
A time, people would say, what's that?
Absolutely. And now the school is working with the Burns Medical School and addressing some of these kind of very unique issues that are being asked throughout the community.
Well, we wish you a very happy anniversary as you and your inaugural class will be celebrating. And nice to have you here. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. Much appreciated.
Alan Ho is a Kekioka Aina born when Hawaii was still a territory. He's a graduate, as we just mentioned, of the inaugural class of the University of Hawaii School of Law. He graduated in 1976, and he was the first University of Hawaii graduate to be appointed to a per diem judge position in 1982 by then Chief Justice William S. Richardson, for whom the law school is named.
Thank you.
The jury isn't out on this one. Guri guri is no ka'oe on Maui. This frozen treat is said to captivate everyone from toddlers to great-grandmas. Its texture is like nothing else, where creamy meets fine ice. The recipe to make this happen remains a closely guarded Tasaka family secret. Now made by a fourth generation, Guri Guri hasn't changed much, and neither has its name. The Tasaka family continues to serve mostly locals, as has since plantation days when customers mispronounced Goody Goody. This small over-the-counter shop still only serves two flavors, strawberry and pineapple. Foregoing expansion hasn't hurt their business in the least. The numbers indicate this mom-and-pop shop is as beloved today as it was over 90 years ago. And earlier, we asked you to guess the number of scoops that change hands each day. The daily tally is 1,500, and that's today's backyard quiz. If you have one, you can send it to Talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bush Consulting, providing IT support, customized network services, and backup recovery for Hawaii's businesses since 1990. Learn more about outsourced IT at buschconsulting.com.
Hawaii is a haven for the extreme athlete. Our climate is ideal for year-round training, and events like last weekend's Tin Man and the Ironman Triathlon are right there to challenge those who would test their endurance to the limit and beyond. Imagine, then, an event in the sparse air of the high Himalayas, the Tenzing Hillary Mount Everest 60K Extreme Ultra Marathon. Petty Officer 3rd Class Craig Longobardi trained for the event when he was at Coast Guard Air Station, Barbers Point. He joins us by phone. Good morning, Craig.
Morning, Chris.
What's the appeal of, this is not your only extreme sports event, what's the appeal for you?
The appeal is just doing something different, out of the blue, something to just stretch the limits and push them as well.
Well, you've certainly accomplished that. I'm trying to imagine what it's like doing a marathon in a place where most people would have trouble walking 100 yards.
There's a couple difficulties, but for me, it's one foot in front of the other and just repeat. It's simple as that. That's why I look at it.
In the thin air, well, give me kind of a description of the event in the Himalayas. It's all above 11,000 feet, right?
That's correct. We fly into, flew into Kathmandu, spent one day in Kathmandu, then we flew up to Lukla Airport, mm-hmm. which is the world's highest and most dangerous airport, and that airport's actually at about 11,000 feet. From Lukla, we did a two-day hike up to Namche Bazaar, and in between the two-day hike, you know, hiked about 6 hours a day with getting acclimatized between that, and from, Namche Bazaar, we spent two evenings getting used to the altitude and doing some local hikes. Then we continued on to the Everest Base Camp, another 5 days of hiking, about approximately 6 to 8 hours a day.
Wow.
Then along that time, we'd also get used to the altitude as well.
You're pretty much gaining altitude with every step on these.
Yes.
As you approach the base camp. And you're reaching the point where there just isn't nearly the proportion of oxygen in the air that we've got down here at sea level, right?
That's correct.
So that's what you need to acclimate to, and among other things, don't you get, you know, if you go too fast, don't you get headaches and all kinds of oxygen deprivation?
Yes, we actually, the group that I hiked with was started out with about 17 people.
Uh-huh.
We lost approximately 7 people to acute mountain sickness.
Wow.
With symptoms of upset stomach, lightheadedness, headaches, tingle, like pins and needles on their fingertips from
sure.
the loss of oxygen.
Circulatory
lip.
Stuff. Well,
yeah.
You know, you're really approaching, and this is just walking, right?
Yes, that's just walking.
So once the event gets underway, what kind of pace can you keep up, and what kind of trails are you on?
Well, once the event got underway, we actually started at the base of the Kimbu Ice Falls at the far side of the Everest base camp.
Uh-huh.
So the first, I'd say about 5 kilometers or so, you're actually running on glacier.
Wow.
So you have boulders, rocks, loose dirt, and ice.
What kind of footwear?
Footwear? Salomon. Use the trail running sneakers through Salomon. Great footwear, great insulation.
So, I mean, you really need to dig in places where there's an actual slippery surface or loose rock underneath you, yeah?
Oh, yeah. I wear a special shoe from Salomon. It's the Felt Cross, and it's similar to a pair of soccer cleats, but made of rubber instead of a hard plastic. So this way, I grip all the rocks.
There can't be more than a few hundred people in the world who even think about competing at this level. Is that right?
That's correct. There's 19 people in the race, including local Nepalese. I've placed 11th overall by 1 second, making it from the top 10, and I was the first American, first military member overall to complete the race.
In athletic events of this nature, Craig, you're going to the absolute limit of, not just to the limit of you know, an athletic capability, but you're going to the very limit of staying alive, right? You're playing with some real fire here in terms of the risk involved and then just the bodily capabilities that, you know, nobody gets to extend to that level. There can't be that much sort of prior experience to draw from in things like this.
No, but that's where working with the Coast Guard, some of our training, since I'm in the aviation program, we had some training in some of our schools. We were brought up to an altitude chamber about 24,000 feet, taking off oxygen and see what the side effects were. That's some of our basic training with the Coast Guard. And so that has helped. And last year I was in India. I was a crew person for Lynn Hewitt in La Ultra, the high. And that was in the northern part of the Himalayas at 17,000 feet. So that's how I got my first experience up at altitude.
You don't want to have your first experience like this up at altitude when you're in the middle of an event, because you don't want surprises by that point, right?
That's correct.
You must have learned an awful lot about yourself as a result of these pursuits, Craig.
Yes, that's one thing I like about these races. I'm trying to push the limit, see what I can learn about myself, and also learning about myself, I can explain it to others so they can do that as well.
What does it do for you, you know, having these kind of things behind you? What does it do for you on a regular day down at sea level? What's different about you because you've done these things?
It's just amazing, like small tasks that I've done prior. Just seems minute and simple now. One of the things I mentioned, and also that was written up in the article, was the Sherpas, the local Nepalese people, how simple and like how proud they are of their job and what they do and how they help us out. Without them, there's no way I could have competed or completed this event, because they were there side by side, hand by hand, and it's amazing what the Nepalese. Yeah.
When Sir Edmund Hillary became the first to summit Everest, he made it very clear that he wouldn't have gotten there without Tenzing Norgay, right?
That is correct.
And that tradition continues to this day on Everest, I understand.
Yes, it does. I was in awe of what these guys could do, and like I have a few photos, and I met with a few of them and spoke with them, and they're extremely humble, and it's just they're very proud people, and I'm just happy and still in awe of the experience I had up there.
Well, it's kind of that lesson being there's always somebody who's gone a few steps further, no matter how far you go, yeah?
That's correct. It all depends on who shows up on race day.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty inspiring stuff, Craig, and I wish you all kinds of luck in your future pursuits, yeah?
Thank you very much.
Craig Longobardi is a petty officer, third class in the United States Coast Guard, who's just returned from the 2013 Tenzing Hillary Everest Marathon. And you can learn more about him on our HPR2.org website.
Falling down.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from St. Andrew's Priory School for Girls, K-12, committed to providing a college preparatory education that inspires the young women of Hawaii to become community leaders. Priory.net.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of Masters and Johnson and their controversial research into human sexuality based on observing volunteers engaged in the act. We talk with Thomas Mayer. His book, Masters of Sex, which has been adapted into a Showtime series, drew on interviews with Virginia Johnson, who died last week. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3.
But then we just talked to a young man who's run a marathon in the high Himalayas, a race that starts at the Everest base camp. And that's quite something to get your mind around.
Yes, that's true. Pushing oneself to limits. Not for everybody, but for him I have two words. Try childbirth.
I imagine. Yeah, well, we males have to do something to simulate that kind of agony. And I can't imagine anything more taxing than running at 11,000 plus feet.
Except trying to breathe.
Yes, exactly. And where oxygen itself is a privilege. But he was quite eloquent about what it had done for him in terms of building some self-confidence and making life's everyday tasks seem relatively manini by comparison.
Which is a very good thing. However, most people aren't going to go to that extreme. There are other ways of learning that.
You could probably gain a pretty valuable perspective on life without ever going near Everest. But still, it's always interesting to see somebody who has made it his task to challenge himself that way.
Well, I'm glad you talked to him, and good on him for doing it.
Exactly.
And surviving.
Yeah. Oh, he's got more in store. Who knows what's next?
Well, we do, at least for tomorrow. We have more in store for you, too. Up in the morning, we're going to talk with the attorney for some of the folks on Kauai who want the Waimea River restored.
And celebrating the many traditions of Tahitian dance on Kauai.
Everything HPR2 is on our website, not coincidentally, called hpr2.org. You can suggest a conversation you'd like to hear or just sound off and post it on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or on Twitter at HI Conversation or at BecauseHPR if you want to get to me.
Past shows, links to more information, and lots of other good things are on the archive on the new and, we hope, easy-to-remember website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandergrift.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.